Greetings, humans. You have entered the Command Zone, your destination for all aspects of Elder Dragon Highlander. Enjoy your stay.
What's the words? Those are the words.
Not me like a shark. Shark man. By the way, we're not recording this on the same day. I'm not changing shirts.
Oh,
yeah. Remember we did this last time?
Yep.
In case you didn't know,
this is a totally different day, obviously, than the last episode with Jesper Ising.
How's it going, everybody? You are listening and watching the Command Zone podcast. I'm your host, Jimmy Wong.
How's it? It's Josh Lee Kwai.
I'm currently in China right now, most likely, and that's why we're recording a bunch of podcasts in a row.
Through movie magic, he's actually here while in China. It's amazing.
And on Ixalan, so hey.
Yeah, in Azcanta.
Is Azcanta, yeah.
So today, we're going to be answering some listener questions, like one we get a lot, which is, my playgroup always targets me first. What do I do?
Yeah.
Is Temple of the False Good actually... Sorry.
False Good?
Is Temple of the False God actually bad?
Now we know it's actually good. The Freudian slip.
And how do you decide when to mulligan or not? But before we get into all of that, we need to talk about our awesome sponsors. First of all, cardkingdom.com/commandzone. If you use that affiliate link when you order your Magic singles, cards, other products, you are supporting this podcast and game nights and all of our content and making sure that the lights stay on and all that stuff keeps flowing.
Yep. Our other sponsor for the show is Ultra Pro. Ultra Pro obviously makes a ton of the products that we get to give away every single time on game nights, as well as the Eclipse sleeves, which now Josh has retrofitted every single one of his decks to have. They make a lot of great products, and obviously they're also moving and evolving with the industry as it goes forward, so always a good sign to see. Thank you, Ultra Pro, for being a sponsor of the show.
And the final way to sponsor the show is directly by going to patreon.com/commandzone, where you can contribute directly to us. There are Patreon rewards. And also, we call out one lucky patron every single episode. And this episode is dedicated to Nicholas Booth. Nicholas, you rock. So let's just jump right into the questions here. And coincidentally, the first question is from Nicholas Booth. How do you think he got chosen as the patron of the week? So Nicholas... I believe this is from an email. It has to be. It's way too long for Twitter. He emailed in.
You'd be surprised, Josh.
some people get 280 characters.
Yeah,
now.
What the heck? I tweet all the time about things. I want 280 characters. Actually, don't give me that.
No, actually, whenever I see a tweet that's got 280 characters, I refuse to read it. It's too much, man.
Dang.
All right. From Nicholas Booth. He says, is it okay to lie in EDH politics? And then he says, now I want to clarify some things. Mm-hmm. The following does not refer to breaking the actual rules of magic. So he's not talking about lying like cheating.
Right.
The following does not refer to saying X and doing Y when Y is clearly contradictory to X. So he doesn't mean lie in the manner of like, I won't attack you. And then the very next turn, I attack you. What he's referring to is when it is not known by other players or it is about something in the realm of the future. It's like something that's hypothetical. So as an example, he says, let's say I attack a player who has no blockers. While other players also don't have blockers. And that player asks, well, why'd you attack me? And I reply with an answer that doesn't have to do anything about the truth in that situation. I say, oh, I chose randomly or whatever. I'm technically lying, but there's no way for them to ever know.
Right.
Because they would have to be able to read my mind in that instance. So the question is that type of lying okay with you? I think this stems from our discussion with the professor when we were talking about like our no-nos. And I was like, man, if you lie to me, it might be blood feud forever. But I was referring to like overt lying, like you say you won't attack me, then you attack it. Or you say I won't destroy that thing, then you destroy it.
Yeah, this seems pretty harmless in terms of like you're not making a promise with the lie. You're just trying to deceive more than anything else. And as long as it's not malicious deceiving, I think that's totally fine. Especially if it's giving you a little political advantage. For instance, let's say it's like, why'd you attack me? And goes like, well, obviously your deck is full of board wipes, so I just want to get... I want to draw those cards out of your hand. And if the other person goes, I don't have board wipes, I'm like, well, I don't know that. So, you can do stuff where you give a little different reason or put the blame somewhere else kind of thing, a little deflection. I can see that happening all the time.
I really like the word you use there, which is deceive. And this to me is not the same as lying, deception.
Right.
It's sort of, it's spin. It's what politics really is.
Yeah.
So to me, this is totally fine. as far as like, it's like I was advocating in a couple episodes back about just expressing concern about a specific card, even though you know for sure you're not going to actually take action against it, mm-hmm. in hopes to bring the other person and be like, well, I want to attack you with it. Just because I could get that for free by just saying something like, man, I really don't like that Steel Hellkite.
I don't think I'm going to remove it.
That's technically a lie.
But no, you could not like the Steel Hellkite.
You could, but you know whether you do or don't.
Right.
There's no way for the other players at the table to know, though. And
unless
so,
you're really bad at lying.
And that's part of what gamesmanship is, I think. And that's well within the realm of okay. I think this is all totally fine. Deception is actually one of the strategies you use. It's the Machiavellian part, the art of war part, stuff we always talk about. And I think that's a lot of where the strategy comes in, is using a little bit of social manipulation to get things to happen, in your favor. So I'm totally okay with it.
I think blue players do this a lot, just holding up two blue mana.
Just saying, like, hold on.
No, wait, hold on.
Okay. I'll let it go.
Touch the lands.
Yeah.
You're good. You're not lying. You're not. You're saying, I might have a response, by the way. The word might says that you could also have no response. Literally no response possible. But you might, right?
It's all just planting a seed so that they worry about it or think about it. You're trying to manipulate them in a way, but I don't consider that lying. You're hiding information or sending out false signals, but that, I think those are different things.
Yeah, I think the question, too, that Nicholas phrased it, is it okay to lie in EDH politics specifically? And I think that is totally fine as long as, again, it's not a malicious lie and it's not like, well, so-and-so, you know, like... being like, well, so-and-so didn't pay his taxes this year, so I'm going to attack you for, like, what? Like, that's like, well, one, I did pay my taxes, but two, like, that's a sort of taking it beyond what the politics of the game, I think, dictate are okay.
All right, let's move on to the second question. This is from Josh.
Not me.
But they didn't provide a last name, so that's all I got. Josh says, I am the known good, quote-unquote, player in my groups. Hmm. And that,
are you sure this isn't you?
And that being the case, I've noticed my deck-building strategy has evolved into making sure I can take the table long enough until I combo out or lose. I'm focused hard no matter what. I want to lower my deck's power level or change my strategy, but how do I do that with the knowledge that I will be focused no matter what? Hmm. When in doubt, kill Josh. That seems to be... a couple of my group's mottos.
That's a tough one.
So this is one we hear a lot, actually. And I think, you know, one of the reasons we hear it a lot is within every playgroup, everyone's going to sort of have a different amount of dedication to Magic, right? For mm-hmm. some people in your group, it's going to be just something they don't think about that much. They just pull their deck out. Maybe they pick up a booster pack here and there and add cards now and then, but they're not like constantly thinking about their deck and focused on like improving it and thinking about past games and things like that. But then there's going to be the players... and they're more likely to listen to a show like this mm-hmm. because you're going on the internet and finding content and trying to figure out, like, how can I up my game? And you're often going to end up being, you know, having a higher win percentage than the other players in your playgroup. And you're going to, I think, find yourself in this position where, listen, that's not going to be a secret. If you're one of the better players in your playgroup, everyone at the table is going to know that.
If they don't, they will find out very quickly as well.
And they're going to respond accordingly because, like Josh says here, when in doubt, kill him first seems to be the motto in some of his playgroups. And that's because that's a reputation that you've earned. There's nothing...
Right.
Like, that hasn't occurred out of nowhere and for no reason. That occurs for a reason. So the question is, how do I lower the power level of my decks or change my strategy so that stops happening?
The problem does not seem to be you lowering the power level of your decks if people insist on killing you first no matter what. Like, if you built up a reputation, it's also partially irresponsible to know how to deal with that reputation. Because just because if you walk into the table and be like, oh, this is a really unpowerful deck, someone that's playing a precon might go, like, it doesn't matter. The power level, even if it is, like, 20% less powerful, is still insurpassable for something for this kind of deck to beat, right? Or, you know, it's, like, really tough because you need to clearly demonstrate to people that the deck you're playing is not of the same power level, but it's also hard to do that because then are you just sacrificing making a fun deck just so that people don't kill you first? Is there a better way of going about it?
I mean, I think, first of all, the thought process can't be like, I'm going to play one time and I'm going to fix this.
Yeah.
I'm going to play 10 times and I'm going to fix it. In all likelihood, you gain this reputation over the course of a number of play sessions. For you to be able to just undo all of that by building like one weak deck is just not realistic.
Or fun. It's just not going to work out in the way I think you might plan for it to happen.
If you do want to change it, I think you're going to have to make a concentrated effort, and it's going to take time. You're going to have to basically spend the same amount of time you spent building your reputation as a strong player to build your reputation as not as strong of a player mm-hmm. or a player. And this goes back to something we talked about, I think, in the episode with Professor. It's a poker term that I use, which is you have to give action to get action.
Right.
In Commander, giving action means allowing people to have their fun, not comboing out, not playing super powerful things all the time. And that gives you the reputation as somebody like, that guy's not always just going to be ruthless. So I can do some other stuff, and I don't have to attack him first because he's not going to be super ruthless. But the problem is you've built your reputation now. You are in the ruthless camp. They are saying, I don't know, when in doubt, attack Josh because he's not going to ever show me any mercy or let me have any of my fun. He's never just going to screw around.
Yeah.
So if you want to change that reputation, you just have to dedicate yourself to a large amount of time demonstrating that you are going to allow people to have their fun.
Yeah, and it also might be something where you talk to the group being like, look, in the past five games, you have targeted me first to the point where I can't even play anything. Can you guys maybe not do that? You know, like it could be one of those things because let's say that they did kill you for good reason. Like by turn two, you play the Hermit Druid every single game. Then, you know, your opponents have no choice. But if it's like turn two, you played a Signet and then they went after you, you know, obviously I think the skewing of their perspective towards you could be fixed by having a conversation in that regard.
But it can only be fixed if they say, okay, don't kill you, and then you don't win that next game. Do not win the game when you make that conversation with them, because otherwise they're just saying, well, see?
Yeah. Don't even, like, play. I mean, like,
your deck purposefully do not win that game.
Yeah, because even if it's like you somehow stumble upon the victory, they're not going to remember that you stumbled upon. They're going to remember the part where you're like, don't kill me, please, and then you ended up doing the thing that they shouldn't. They're like, why did I let you off the hook
in the first place, if
that was going to happen?
Be realistic. You, no matter what happens that one game, they're not going to suddenly change everything they think about you as a player.
Yeah, never.
You have to show over the course of a longer period of time, you know. And again, I believe heavily in that philosophy. Whereas I will try to win some games, but some games I'll mess around. And I am really looking at the games I mess around where I'm not really, it's not that I'm not trying to win. I'm just not going to go find the best card in every situation. I might find Mind's Dilation and play it. That's a good card. It's not an amazing card in this situation because I really want to keep my reputation in that nice wheelhouse of like, Josh will mess around sometimes and do the suboptimal play. And so I don't have to just attack him first every time because he will show no mercy. And you have to work really hard to keep yourself in that, you know, because if you go up here, now you're too ruthless, you know, and you don't want to be way down here where you're just losing a ton of games. So good luck to you, Josh. It's a tough juggling act, but again, it's going to take time more than anything.
It's nice that you got to answer a question you asked yourself. That's good. I'll include one later on from me, too. All right, question number three.
If I was going to do that, I would just use a pseudonym. I wouldn't actually said Josh. I'm smarter than that. Unless.
Jury's still out. All right, question number three comes from Kevin Anthony. Kevin asks, I've seen a lot of talk online recently about Temple of the False God with many prominent commander players or, I guess, podcasts calling the card bad. Yet I've heard you guys talk about being a staple card in the format before, and it occupies a spot next to Sol Ring in the opening of every Game Night's video. Who is wrong about this card? He's talking about the intro sequence we have in Game Nights where we're sliding it into a sleeve.
First of all, that doesn't mean...
Yeah, just because it's like next to a card.
It just means that the shot was good, and Temple of the False God is a card that sees play in Commander. Although I do not think Temple of the False God is bad. I do think it's good and belongs in most decks.
I do too. I think that the way that people see it and the way that people keep hands with it is the problem with it.
I also think the way they build their deck with it. But go ahead.
Yeah, so for instance, let's say you draw an opening hand. It's got land, Temple of the False God, Signet, and then four playables.
You can't keep that hand.
You cannot keep that hand. The way that Temple of the False God looks in that hand is it's as though you drew six cards, and the card that is Temple of the False God will not work until you have four other lands in play, and then you can play it. But when you do get a land, let's say your hand is three lands in the Temple of the False God, then you have to look at your hand as though you are still one card down and not treat Temple of the False God like a land. It's sort of like when I put Maze of Ith in the deck and I'm like, oh, that's a land, right? It's like, no, you actually have to look at it in a different perspective when it can actually function as a land. For instance, if you have Maze of Ith and an Urborg in your deck, then sometimes that maze will be able to tap for mana. But for the most part, it is not a land until certain requirements have been met for Temple specifically. It's a land you can play, but it's not going to be a useful land for you.
I love the comparison to Maze of Ith, right? I think that's exactly how you should look at Temple of the False God. Maze of Ith doesn't occupy a slot in your deck that counts as a land. When you go on a tapped out and you build your deck and you're like, I want 38 lands in this deck, if you have Maze of Ith in there, You need, that's your 39th land. It's not mm-hmm. your 38th land. Temple of the False God occupies what we'd call the ramp category, but it should not occupy something in the land category.
Yeah, maybe so, it's like half foot in at most.
Yeah, I wouldn't even count it. So like if I want 37 lands in a deck, I'll have 38 lands, but Temple of the False God is the 38. It's a ramp spell. Think of it like Explosive Vegetation or something. It costs 4 mana to cast. It costs 4 lands to cast it.
Right.
But when you do, you immediately get 2 lands, and it doesn't actually cost you any mana. It's like once you have 4 lands in play, you can play this spell.
Yeah.
Right? And it taps for 2 mana. But you can't think of it as a regular land. So I think the card is good, and it really helps out a lot of color combinations. You know, Boros, Mono White, Red White, Grixis, anything without green wants to run Temple of the False God, but you got to be smart about deck building. And then when you get it in your hand, you're not thinking of it as a land, you're thinking of it as a spell.
Yeah, you almost have to put it, next to the 5 drops, so the 6 drops in your hand, because you just will not effectively be able to use it until then, unless you're ramping out lands onto the battlefield.
Yeah, so if you're counting it, like I've got 33 lands in my deck, is Temple of the False God one? Well, you have 32 lands in your deck.
And then you're shooting yourself even more in the foot, because like what? You have a chance to draw less lands in general. Yeah, and you have a chance to draw it in your opening hand. Let's say you are like desperately top decking for a land and Temple comes up. It's just like there's a lot of downsides if you don't build around it as though it wasn't a real land in your deck.
But on those times, if you don't think of it as a land and you think of it more like a spell, on those times where you do have it in your hand and you only have 3 lands in play, it shouldn't strike you as like, oh, this card is bad. Yeah. This is a problem you're having where you couldn't cast any 4 drop in that instance. And if you look at it like that, it's a land count problem more than anything, maybe, if that's happening a lot. It's at least not the problem with Temple of the False God itself.
Yeah, so I would say that your friends and the people you've heard from aren't necessarily wrong. I would just give Temple of the False God a different look and perspective before just outright saying, nope, it's bad.
All right. Question number 4. Another question we get asked a lot. In fact, we get asked so much I didn't actually attribute the question to anyone. It's, do tutors count as card draw?
Nope. They account as,
there's 2 ways to answer this question. The first is the tutor itself, when you cast it, is that card draw? The answer is no.
No.
You are getting a card. Depends on the tutor. Actually, some you're not. Enlightened Tutor, Vampiric Tutor.
A lot of them put it on top of the
But library. Demonic Tutor, yes, you did technically put a card into your hand, but that's a cantrip, right? Play a card, get a card. That's not card draw.
Card selection, obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, like, there's a lot of upsides to tutors, but thinking about it as card draw does not make sense.
But the fact that it can go get your card draw spell, and we've talked about this before, mm-hmm. whereas tutors kind of count as every effect in your deck that they can go tutor for. So
it's like the spike in
demonic,
your deck.
Yeah, Demonic Tutor counts as every card in your deck plus 2 mana, right?
Mm-hmm.
So is it a single target removal spell? Yeah. Is it a board wipe? Yeah. Is it ramp? Yeah. Is it
a creature? Is it a planeswalker? Yep.
So in that respect, is it card draw? Yeah. Yeah, it is. I can go get Rhystic Study with it
mm-hmm.
If I didn't have that in my hand before. It's a very flexible card draw spell. It's a modal spell almost.
Yeah.
Enlightened Tutor is different in that it can't get the same amount of things. Like Enlightened Tutor is, depending on what you have in your deck, it might not be single target removal. You might not have Oblivion Ring or something like that.
Ancient Lights, yeah.
Yeah. It's probably not, Enlightened Tutor is probably not a board wipe. I guess you could go get Nivineral's Disc, but it's less likely to be. But if you have Rhystic Study in your deck, Enlightened Tutor, it's sort of card draw in what it can get. But the tutoring itself is not card draw.
Yeah, and the reason that we put tutors in our deck is so that if we need a card draw spell, we can grab it. If we need a board wipe, we can get it. You know, it's to give yourself that flexibility. In fact, a lot of tutors count as card disadvantage to a certain degree because you actually replace a draw step with that card. So let's say you're trying to make sure you hit all of your land drops. You're guaranteed not going to if you put the card on top of your library and you look for it.
Yep.
Unless you have a way to draw through that card.
All right. Well, hope that answers that question. I know we'll get asked it again.
At some point.
Yep. Question number 5 is from Matt Newman. Matt begins by explaining he's a recently converted Yu-Gi-Oh! Player, which I thought was interesting. He says that he's really enjoyed his foray into Commander, but the multiplayer setting has him flummoxed a bit.
Good word.
So this is actually from Matt. Would you guys have any tips on how to play a more political game? In your experience, is it worth it trying to adjust a deck to help incorporate politics, or just work on your own game plan and try to make deals throughout a game?
In general, I haven't found that many cards that incorporate politics that well. There are assault suits out there. There's like Rite of the Raging Storm, one of our preview cards. And those cards are pretty powerful in their own right. But at the same time, it gives players and everyone else a lot of chances to make their own choices and to choose what goes towards where, you know, like, oh, who's going to get this token randomly off of this thing. So I always prefer to make my deck to work the way I want it to and then play the politics in game to make sure that that end goal is met.
Yeah, 100% agree. I don't think I've ever played a card only because, you know, it allows me to play politics. Because every card, in some respect, allows you to play politics.
Yeah.
That's kind of one of the cool things about Commander. And we'll talk about cards sometimes and say, well, it can be political because... And that's kind of like a one of the upsides of the card, but I want that to be gravy.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So let's say I've got a mana rock and it taps for mana, but I could actually give that mana to other players if I feel like.
Right. I think Rite of Lantern.
Play that because I can. That's just an upside of it. I'm playing it because most of the time I'm going to give myself the mana.
Yep.
But the ability to occasionally give somebody else mana is, you know, something that one out of 50 times I might be able to use or leverage. Mm-hmm. Swords to Plowshares is really that too, though, because I can cast it on many different things.
Yeah.
So sometimes I can get rid of something that's problematic for you in exchange for a favor. Now, most of the time I'm going to get rid of something that's problematic for me, but Swords to Plowshares is not a political card. It just has some political gravy on top of it. And that's how I would build my decks. I would not be looking to build... I mean, you can build a fun deck, a theme deck that's all about political cards, and that's kind of the theme of that deck. I think that's a different thing. But in general, most of my decks... I'm just playing cards that are advancing my own game plan or covering weaknesses.
Yeah.
And I plan on finding those little political situations on my own throughout the game to sort of, you know, exploit or navigate or negotiate or whatever.
Yeah. Matt, it is good, though, that you're thinking about having a game plan. I think that's very important when building a deck. At the very baseline, even if you're building a deck for politics, the game plan should be, I'm going to do this to be political or whatever. Or the game plan should be, I'm doing this so I can beat face with this creature. You know, but having that game plan will help solidify everything else. So you're already on the right path. Good job.
Good job.
Good job.
Yu-Gi-Oh taught you well.
Good job.
I have no idea how Yu-Gi-Oh works, even though we were in that Rocket Jump video where...
It is bizarre. I don't know if you've ever played Yu-Gi-Oh out there, listeners or watchers, but we did a little skit, and we'll post it, and we'll tell you guys
about
it when
it gets
posted.
Will it be out
by now? It should be out sometime in November, so we'll talk about it on an end step. I don't know the exact dates yet, but Josh and I were playing two shady...
Yu-Gi-Oh players,
yeah, gambling for cards, anteing, and... I read the rules and I was like, what is happening?
I actually watched some Yu-Gi-Oh stuff on YouTube just to get an idea for how they move the cards around and stuff. They flick the cards just like we do.
Oh, they definitely flick the cards,
yeah.
And they shuffle and everything.
But I had no idea what was going on. I'm watching like the Yu-Gi-Oh World Championships and I'm just like...
They also like do this thing, like, where they slam it down and, yeah, you know, they just look at the other player. They don't even announce what they're doing and the other player just knows. Magic, you usually say like, I'm going to play Scavenging Ooze.
Although, you know, you've seen like the Brian Kibler thing,
yeah,
the bonfire where they just flip it over
top,
and top,
yeah,
it, and then everyone goes, because they know what happens.
Yeah, I mean, that's a little different. This is like every move, there's just silent, dead staring at each other. I'm like, geez, you guys are crazy. You guys are so into it right now.
All right, question number 6 is from Jason Faber. How do you decide whether you should mulligan or not? This is a good question. I'm surprised we haven't tackled this on an episode before.
Yeah.
But because it's not an entire episode, but we could do a lengthy discussion.
Depending on mulligan rules, it changes a lot. So let's say we're playing by normal rules, which is after you mulligan once, you go down to 6, and then you're allowed to scry 1. Now,
you go down to 7
first.
You
go down to 7, and then you go down to 6. Yeah. So for Commander, you get a quote-unquote free mull.
In all multiplayer Magic.
Yeah. I think you should almost always take the free mull if you are even in the slightest doubt of your hand. Especially if it's like, well, I need this to happen in order to have this work. You can't fall that far behind in Commander, because when you lose a turn, it's not like your opponent just gets one turn. Three opponents get a turn as opposed to your one. So the insurmountable odds are just harder and harder to get over after a certain point.
But what specifically are you looking for in your hand to know whether it's even borderline or not?
If I have some kind of card draw that I know I can reasonably cast, I almost always keep it.
Does that mean I can cast it with the cards currently in my hand?
I can either cast it with a card currently in my hand, or I know that my deck is one that is going to be able to make sure I can get there. So, for instance, like, oh, there's a Rampant Growth in here and an Aristic Study, and I have two
lands.
You
can cast that with the cards in your hand.
Right. That's a good point. I think you shouldn't have to... I think you should have... Like, the ideal hand for me is 3 lands, maybe 4. 2 cards you can cast with those cards in your hand, and then 2 cards that are important to your deck, or, you know, like, you want to have in your hand. So it could be like a 7-mana board wipe or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think for me, I'm looking for mostly the same things. I want to be able to cast I want to be able to look at my hand and cast at least a couple of the cards. I almost always want three lands. Two is acceptable depending. So if I have a ramp card. Mm-hmm. But really, I don't know if I'm looking at lands exactly or if I'm looking like amount of mana that I guarantee to have access to without drawing any other mana source.
Right.
So if I've got a Signet and two lands, that's three mana. That's fine. I know that by, you know, turn three, I'm going to have access to at least three mana, hopefully four. I really would like, in that instance, to be able to draw some cards somehow in my hand. I would also consider the colors. I think, you know, let's say I'm in a three-color deck and all my mana is red mana. It's not great. I'm probably going to mull that hand depending.
Yeah.
You know, let's say I have, you know, two mountains and then some kind of mana rock that only creates red mana. You know, one of those diamonds or something.
Even
I don't know
like two mountains
and
a Signet that may create one of the other colors.
But I don't have my third.
You don't have your third, yeah. I mean, like, you want to make sure that you're... It's like, you know, going on a road trip, doing anything, making sure your car has the gas, making sure that you are ready to take and tackle on whatever's at the table. Also, if you see that you're playing against a bunch of really aggressive players or a bunch of players with combo, that's that can change your hand as well. So, for instance, if you have a counterspell in your hand and you know that Johnny over there is going to go off and be infinite in no time whatsoever, then that hand increases in value. So you may even be like, well, I only have two lands, but I know I only have one counterspell, so I need to keep this because if he goes off, then I can't win no matter what kind of stuff.
I think there's some stuff that throws a wrench into this and causes us to make, you know, worse decisions. There's two cards in particular that'll do it. One is Sol Ring.
Mm-hmm.
And I see, actually, you see a surprising amount of people who get Sol Ring turn one and end up having a bad hand that they basically kept because they had a land and a Sol Ring. If you only have land Sol Ring, I don't think it's probably that great depending on what the land is. Because
and the other cards, but yeah, that you only have three mana. Let's say you never draw another land for the next three turns. Are you going to still be able to play anything, or are you 100% reliant on being able to draw that land?
And you only have one colored mana, so yeah. There's probably a lot of cards you can draw that you can't even play with that one colored mana. I mean, maybe that one land is a command tower, in which case that keep is probably okay. But also, yeah, if you don't draw a land the next turn and you don't draw one the next turn, that Sol Ring didn't do anything for you. You're now just equal on the amount of mana that everybody else had. Why Sol Ring is good is because on turn two, you have four mana, and turn three, you have five mana.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not going to have land on turn two and three, then all of a sudden you're just kind of playing a Sol Ring and then being equal to everybody. That's not what I want. And then the other card I think that makes people sort of screw this up is Sensei's Divining Top.
Yeah, I'm at fault for this 100%.
This is the one that still gets me a lot.
Yeah, I mean, you're like, great, I can play this and I can look at the top three cards and always make sure I hit that land. But the thing is, after you look at the top three cards, you're only looking at the one new card each turn because you're drawing a card per turn. And then when you do the next top three, you've seen two of those cards, you only see one more. So it's not like you get a fresh look at three every time.
It's pretty easy to get into a situation where the top three cards are not lands and you can't do anything. The top's not helping you get out of that position.
Yeah.
So I'm
now,
sort
having
of...
shuffle effects is nice. So having fetch lands and the Sensei's Divine Top makes me more inclined to keep that.
Yeah, I think if I had a fetch land and the top and that was it.
No, you can't even play that. You need fetch land top for me to really be happy keeping that hand.
In which case you got two lands and a top. I think two lands and a top is mostly fine.
Yeah.
Because you just really need to find a third, and then especially if one of them is a fetch. But one land and top, definitely don't keep that hand. Two lands and top is still questionable. I want three lands.
What about Ancient Tomb and top? What I did for game nights one time.
No, I don't think that's good. Again, that's one land and top and no colors.
No.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But top gets you in that kind of... And a lot of times when I'll draw my opening hand and I have a top or Sol Ring, I'll kind of look at the hand without that card.
Uh-huh.
And say, would I keep this hand without that card? And if the answer is no, I probably won't. Sol Ring will change it more than top in that instance where maybe I got two lands and Sol Ring and it's my third mana. Then I will. But I don't think one land in either of those is good. And two land in either one is probably still not
great.
You're
just putting yourself up for such a blowout for your own sake if you do that. Because, again, you're not just losing one turn. You're losing every person at the table's turn. You get far behind very quickly.
I think something else you have to consider is your deck, obviously. And I think when you have a lot of decks, this gets a little bit tougher. Because it's like, okay, this deck has X amount of ramp or X amount of card draw. Or my commander does one of those things, ramp or card draw, then it would change that calculation a lot. Just keep in mind what your commander is. Also, what CMC your commander's at, how dire it is that you get them out. Like, if you're playing Animar, you need to get Animar out on turn three.
Yeah.
You need a starting hand that will cast Animar on turn three. You don't want a starting hand with only two lands, because if you never hit that third land, your deck won't even start to go.
Yep.
Unless you have a Birds of Paradise or something else that's going to get you there. Again, that would count as, I guess I said land, but when I really meant mana.
It's that glass cannon, yeah.
Yeah, but I would consider that stuff pretty heavily as far as like what my commander is, what the buildup of the deck is. You know, certain decks have like that Tashana deck that I played on game nights. That has like 32 ramp cards because all the elves tap for mana. You know, start with one forest because I have so many, you know, other things. But a deck that doesn't have that wouldn't be able to even think about it. So,
yeah. All right. Question number 7 comes from Matt Black. This is actually a very good question, and I don't know if my answer is right, actually. I've heard, don't counter the tutor, counter what they find. Not sure if it's a good idea or not.
I think it depends on basically it two factors.
Depends. Yeah.
Well, really just one factor, I think. The factor is, are they playing a recursion type of deck for the effect?
Right.
So if they're playing Caridor, Marin, whatever, and they go to tutor, I want to counter the tutor. Because they don't care if I counter the thing, it's going to go to the graveyard where they can get it back. If they're playing a deck that's not built around recursion, you know, if you're playing an Animar deck, I probably want to counter what you tutor for, because now you don't also have the ability to tutor for it again or draw it in some other way.
Yeah, that's definitely the reanimation thing makes a huge difference. I didn't even think about that. For me, it's just, are you trying to hold that counter up for someone else in this turn cycle? Like, let's say the next person that went after you tutors for something, but you know that Josh, who's two seats away, is the biggest danger in the threat. Do you need to save your tutor for that? In which case, wait for it. If you have like a really conditional tutor though, and it's like counter target creature spell, and you know that they're searching for anything in the deck, then obviously you're in a real rough spot, because then you're hoping they play a creature that you can counter off it. But I would say, in general...
Yeah, well, but if you have Swansong, it's not going to counter a creature. You have to counter the tutor.
Yeah, and Swansong works in a way that is exactly as the name implies, is that it's like this out-of-nowhere, like, coup de grace, like, thank goodness you're here kind of savior thing. So, I think holding on to counter magic is a really viable play. You just have to be careful, because you could also just sit there and hold on to it forever, and then what's the point of it being in your deck?
I do think the default, all things being equal, is counter the thing they tutored for.
Yeah.
But you do have to consider the other factors of, like, what kind of deck is it? Is it the type of deck where if I counter the thing, it's just going to come right back out of the graveyard? In which case, I don't want them to have it in their hand at all, so I got to counter the tutor. But that's not, you know, the percentage times when that's the right play is like 10 or 15% compared to most of the time, counter what they tutor for. Also, they might tutor for something that you don't even care about or you want to happen. Like, maybe they got a board wipe or a single target removal spell. And so that's how I would think about that.
I would also say that countering at the right time when they try and cast the spell, if they can't get it back from the graveyard, there's also a huge tempo blowout for them, as opposed to them paying 3 mana for a tutor spell.
That's a good point. If they tutor for Tooth and Nail, then go to cast Tooth and Nail, they've wasted 11 mana rather than 2 mana or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
It's way better for you. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Question number 8. On this one, the names have been omitted to protect the innocent.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes people email us and they're like, listen, if you talk about it on the show, please don't mention my name. If you say that, we will not mention your name,
Pretty sure the playgroup should know, though.
Well, there's probably a lot of people this applies to, right? They're like, I think this might be John. John, did you write that? And he's like, no, I really didn't.
I didn't, I swear. Why is it username John?
So whoever asked to have their identity not revealed, you're screwing over John here.
Yeah, sorry, John.
Sorry, John. How do you try and deal with someone in a playgroup when they complain constantly about being a target, yet they build decks that kind of make them a threat at the table? Now, this is a callback to our earlier question. So this is the flip side.
Yeah.
How do you deal with the people that are the same people that earlier complained
but
that they always are the first target?
Yeah, they're making them... I don't know. I mean, like, if it's that hard to really get the message through after teaming up and killing them a few times, I wish you the best of luck, because usually that's the best way for someone to realize, oh, okay, I can't just play like this or whatever, is when they lose or when 3 other people at the table all have vendettas against that person and will relentlessly swing at them until they go down. Like, I don't know, that's like not as fun to me, because it's like hazing someone, like a trial by fire to try and teach them something. But
listen, if you leave people no other out but to kill you, otherwise, like I said, you don't give any action, you're not going to get any action. So to me, I would just make sure that I'm explaining to them why that's happening. If you're complaining, like, you guys always target me first, my response is going to be like, yes, because you make that the strategical imperative.
Yeah.
And that's in your seat. As soon as you start playing a little bit looser, having a little bit more fun, not just trying to be as ruthless and merciless as possible, then maybe we won't do it. Until then, you get what you get. Like, you get what you give.
you are being a threat for your deck power and all that stuff, and we haven't seen a clear demonstration that you want to change. So, yeah.
And by the way, you doing that one time is not going to change our mind. Nope. We need to see like a concentrated effort over time.
Yeah.
Yep. You do that, you won't be the first target. You don't. Listen, this is the way that, like, this is how strategy games work.
That's how it works.
Yeah. Question number 9.
Spencer.
I've been playing a couple of decks for a while, and they're starting to get stale. There hasn't been anything printed in a while that goes in them, and I'm not having fun playing them. Do you guys have any advice on what to do in a situation like this?
Well, my first thing is you can always just disassemble it, and that's very hard for Commander players to do, but if you really aren't finding excitement to play that deck anymore, or maybe the mechanic you built it around just doesn't work, and even if they did release new cards, it wouldn't have been that great. For instance, I remember when Energy came out in Kaladesh, I was like, that's it, I'm going to build an Energy-themed deck, and I thought about it and realized that if Energy never comes back, then this is going to be a two-set deck, and then, like, obviously a lot of proliferate. So, like, I would just disassemble that deck if I'm not having fun with it anymore.
You know, that's great advice, and I think that once you do it, it's very freeing, because what happens is your deck has a bunch of cards in it, and you're like, you know, I don't want to take that. I want to use that card in another deck, or I'd build another deck, but it's in this deck.
Yeah.
But I never play that deck. But it's hard to take that part that deck because I spent all that time building it and whatnot.
I don't want to take all the sleeves out. Yeah.
And once you do, a lot of times, like I've done this recently because of game nights where I've sort of been forced to take apart some decks to build other ones. Yep. And now I have this big pile of cards and I'm like, I have this. I have a Sword of Feast and Famine. And, you know, oh.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh, I can build a whole nother deck and I'm excited again. And so I think disassembling the deck is actually really good advice.
Not to mention, sometimes that's the best way to make an old stale deck that doesn't work better, is that you take it apart, you put it across the table and realize, wow, I have 6/9 drops.
Yeah.
You know, or like, wow, I don't have any ramp in this deck, or there's no card draw, you know, so that's a great way to rebuild that deck from the ground up, should you choose. Otherwise, it's a great way to cannibalize that deck.
You can always put it back together, write down the deck list. It's not going to be like,
yeah,
like you're not going to lose anything. You still have all those cards. Another thing I would say, and this sounds a little bit like lack of inspiration to build new decks.
Yeah.
Borrow some of your friends' decks. Just be like, hey, can I play one of your decks? That might just get you a taste for what you like, something else you like. I think a lot of people think if they do that, then I'm going to want to build exactly my friend's deck. But a lot of times there'll be like a card or two that you play in their deck that makes you go, oh, I'd like to do that more. I don't want to build their deck. I want to build a card. I want to build a deck that
uses that card.
Uses these types of cards. Yeah. Just does something like that. So
yeah, I often do that. I'll take notes during a game and be like, I really like that interaction. I want to do more of that.
Craig Blanchett has this great system where he just takes pictures of cards while we're playing.
Yeah.
So he's constantly like, what is that? Hold on, can I borrow it? And he just takes a picture of it. And at the end of every Commander game, he's got two or three pictures of cards that he just wants to go find uses for, or cards that he thought were cool. Not even cards necessarily. He's like, this goes in this deck. Just like, that's a cool card. Oh, Craig, he's the best.
All right, our 10th question and final question comes from Ben Stanford. And he has a very Stanford question. It's a very smart question. The question is, when is it smart to spare opponents, if ever?
So I assume Ben means like when you have the possibility to kill them.
Yeah, you're holding them. You're
when
like,
is it smart not to kill them?
When they have things to promise you. Now, here's the thing. Everyone at that point is going to have a whole lot of things to promise you. It's like the bad guy when he's holding on to the cliff, right? It's not Mufasa. It's Scar when he's right about to fall off. And he goes, no, please don't. I'll do anything. Whatever you want.
They always say that. Sometimes it's worth it, though.
Sometimes it is, especially, and this is how I've gotten myself out of sticky situations before. Even though I kind of know I'm still going to lose because I'm just way too low, and that if anyone else wants to try and kill me, they might be able to. Even just giving yourself one turn cycle to cause a little more chaos and havoc, I don't know, I do enjoy that quite a bit. Especially, like, I've had times where, again, like, I have, like, a Sulfuric Vortex or a card that's going to kill me or do something. I'll be like, well, you know what, I'm going out anyway, so let me do something at least on the way out. It's not going to affect you, I promise, but it's going to kill everyone else. And because you spared me, I will dedicate my life to you.
I will dedicate you. I think a lot of it has to do with a couple of things. One is, how hard of a lockdown do you have on the fact that you can KO them? How fragile is it? Is it like, I have Event Sentinel, you're at, in three defenders, and you're at three.
Yeah.
Which means on board, as long as I hold this mana open, there's basically nothing you can do. I can kill you. Even if you board wipe in response, I can kill you.
Yeah.
And I can do it at instant speed. That's a real hard lockdown on somebody, which means you can kind of trust any promise they make. And you can sort of use that to your advantage because maybe you've got that, but they have a bunch of creatures right now.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be advantageous for you to have them point all those creatures at one of your enemies. And they're going to die anyway, so you can be like, okay, I'll give you one more turn, but you have to attack everything at this person. You cannot cast anything that targets any of my permanents.
Yeah.
You cannot hit my life total or anything like that. The only thing you can do is it has to be pointed at them, and in which case I will not kill you. And you make the terms of the deal. That can totally be worth it.
Yeah.
And it can give you sort of a weapon that you didn't have.
Use me as your weapon.
And a lot of times they're happy to do it. It gives them another turn. They get to do fun stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and they might find a way out of it. There's always that little ray of hope. Well, maybe I have something with split second, or maybe I have a something that counters an ability, or blah, blah, blah.
Like time stop or something.
Yeah.
Here's the thing, too, is you'll know that the person is making a good deal and has a good case if other players at the table start being like, no, 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 kill him. Kill him. What are you doing? No, no, no. End their life. I don't want to have to deal with this, like, one rogue person coming after me because you know, essentially have them by a leash because they can die at any point thanks to you.
I also think a big factor is where you're seated in comparison to them at the table.
Oh, right.
So I would really want that person to be going next after me because I would want to have a very hard lockdown and not fragile, like, or else I can trust them. So if it's Jimmy, I know he's not going to just lie to me.
You never
right?
know.
Yeah,
what was the question? When can I lie?
It's very doubtful. I would say, don't attack me. You say, okay, I'm not going to attack you. Then you would just attack me. That's not going to happen. So in that case, I would consider that a pretty hard lock for the next turn. So I'll give you one more turn. You have to attack everything at so and so. But I would still not want to make that deal if you're going right before me. I want you to be the next player acting because I don't want the other two players to now have the ability
to
influence
affect,
you.
Yeah, yeah, and change what might happen.
They might make a different deal with you or they might kill a bunch of your stuff, in which case, well, you might as well just be dead because now you can't help me anyway.
Yeah, what if someone was like, look, I have a way for you to gain life, right? Like,
yeah.
And then everything changes.
Yeah.
Know? So you want to make sure that you have as much control over that as possible.
Yeah, so I'm really interested in where everybody's sitting when I make those deals in comparison to the people I want them to act against and in comparison to me. So I think that's another factor.
Knowledge of their deck too. Let's say they promise something and I've done this before where I'm like, I'm going to do as much damage as I can to this person next turn. And it's like five.
But hey, if that's your promise.
That was my promise.
I remember
and the person
going five. That's horrible. I'm
I think
not
it was actually seven
again.
At this point. Yeah. But you know, so obviously you want to look at their deck and make sure that whatever they are promising, they can follow through on to whatever your acceptable terms is. I think it is a little bad manners to be like, look, I have Cryptic Command. I'm going to use it on this part, you know, instead of saying the cards out loud. I'm never a huge fan of that. But if it does come down to that, having some insurance, knowing what they're going to do is good.
Yeah. Yeah. So
especially if it's on board.
But to answer your question, Ben, I think it is smart to spare opponents when they're useful to you and there's a very low percentage chance that they can kind of get out of the vice
right.
that you've got them in. And also, you want to be in a position that the other players in the table aren't. So if you've got the Vent Sentinel, like I said, and you can just, you know, ping them to death, but somebody else can also ping them to death, that means it's too wishy-washy in that circumstance. The other person can make the same promise you did, then what do they do? I want to be the only person that has the power of life and death over them at this moment, obviously, at the very least. Otherwise, it's just not worth the risk. I'm probably just going to take them out if it's too muddy.
Yeah.
But if it's clear, listen, I'm the only one that can get rid of them, but I can get rid of them anytime I want, then they're a weapon in my hand.
Yep. Now it's just up to them whether or not they want to make that deal, too. Because a lot of opponents will just be like, I'm dead, I die.
A lot of times, and I've been that person where I don't want to be the weapon in their hand. I just don't.
Yeah, especially if that person
is the... I'm just like, no, just go ahead,
kill
me.
Or yeah, like, I'm not going to let you control me like this. I'm not going to bow to your terrorist demands.
Yeah, and I got a lot of respect for that player, too. He's like, nope, just kill me.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I just won't be ruled by somebody else. And that's fine, too. But there's plenty of players who are like, listen, I will live at any means necessary.
Yeah, let me give me one more turn, please.
Let me throw one more punch, even if it's at a random person.
Yeah.
All right. That's going to do it for our Q&A episode today.
It's a little shorter,
sorry, y'all. Because Jimmy's in China.
Yeah. We're also recording 3 podcasts today, and I can already feel myself slipping into the realms of chaos and despair. So.
Okay, so let's move on to the listeners. Do you have any questions you'd like us to answer in a future episode? Leave a comment, send us a tweet or an email, and we tend to do these every few months as the questions pile up and we think there are enough enough questions with interesting answers.
And I know a lot of people have emailed us with long paragraphs, pages of stuff. And just because we don't answer them maybe in that email necessarily, also it would take us a little bit of time to really process all of it. We do sometimes put them in these episodes instead. So we do see all of your emails. Make sure you guys tweet at us or on Patreon as well. If someone asks a question or messages us, we get back to them as soon as possible because they are our most treasured friends and supporters.
I mean, I love all the comments, tweets, emails, Facebook messages that are helping us to figure out what we can talk about on the show. That's just super helpful to us. Yeah. So if you have anything that you think about, now I'm not promising we're going to use it all, but quite a few of our episodes have come from little seeds or directly from people saying, you know what, this is an interesting thing that I would like to hear you guys talk about. So really appreciate that. You are helping the show when you do that. Another way to help the show is to go to cardkingdom.com/commandzone. We say this all the time, but it's totally true. You're going to buy Magic cards anyway. Yeah. You're listening to a Magic podcast about Commander. You buy Magic cards. So all you have to do is use that affiliate link when you choose to buy your cards, and you're simultaneously getting cards and keeping the Command Zone and game nights on the air.
Yep. So cardkingdom.com/commandzone. They'll just take you right to their front page, peruse their wares, and buy something.
Yeah. I mean, I hope that we've demonstrated, you know, over the years, we've given you at least a few hours of entertainment. I mean, I hope that's worth a couple of bucks for you.
I hope so, too. Our other sponsor for the show, of course, Ultra Pro. They are products you can buy at Card Kingdom, at any LGS, really. And you know what? They make high-quality products. They printed these playmats that you see in front of you right now, and we chose them to help print our playmats because the print quality was so high. These will last a very long time. I've taken mine to many pre-releases, folded it up, stuffed it in a bag, and it still looks just as good as the day I got it. So thank you, UltraPro, for being a sponsor of the show.
Oh, end step time.
End step.
I got lost. I was like, where are we?
Where are
we? This is where we talk about something cool outside the world of Magic. Speaking of world.
World. I am in China.
And I think, okay.
We haven't said that
we're
enough.
Planning into the future here, but I think, sorry if we're wrong by a day or two, but I think 2 days ago from when you're watching this was League of Legends Worlds.
Yeah, League of Legends Worlds Championship taking place in Beijing where TSM took it all the way home. Incredible. What a come from behind victory. No one would have expected it. TSM actually got eliminated before the semifinals this year.
So it can't be them. What are you doing exactly while you're there?
So I believe I'm going to be doing a lot of talent relations and a lot of coordination behind the scenes as I speak Chinese fluently, and there are a lot of people that don't speak Chinese fluently. And there's going to be a whole week of rehearsals. There's an awesome League of Legends live show. Hopefully you guys can catch it. It's going to be on Twitch. They'll re-upload to YouTube. But
those things get like the same amount of views as like the Super Bowl. Yeah, it's crazy. We have like 40 million people watch it.
Yeah, we have tons of musical artists playing as well as some Chinese artists. And there's going to be a huge amount of cosplayers there. They're going to be showing off their cosplay in front of visuals as well as being accompanied by an orchestra. There's going to be a lot of stuff going on. It's an awesome celebration of the community aspect of League of Legends, what I really got into League for originally, and what I hosted the show about. So if you guys watch that on Twitch, you'll potentially see me running around behind the scenes and making sure everyone gets their places on time and all that. And then the week prior to that, I'm going to make sure I take everyone to as many delicious restaurants as possible.
Jimmy Wong, where do you find the time? Where did you find the cloning machine? You found the Ryan Seacrest cloning machine, didn't you?
Slowly dying right now.
Jimmy, juggling a lot of projects right now. Always. It's pretty amazing. Something else that's amazing.
Oh, SKT is going to win, probably.
So just for real?
Probably, yeah.
Shot calling?
Four-peat, by the way.
I don't know. I haven't paid attention to, unfortunately, in a couple years.
Not many teams can go four in a row at the World Championships.
They've won the last three?
Yeah.
Okay, they're probably going to win. They seem dominant.
Yeah, they have the Tom Brady of the sport.
Oh, well, then they're definitely going to win. Did everybody see Cassius Marsh, by the way, in that field goal?
He blocked a field goal.
It would have been about 3 weeks ago now.
He did like a little stint and just jumped right in between the blocks.
He was like, jump like this between, so they fit between the two guys sideways, and then just jump and block. And the best was Magic Twitter. Terry, put up the field goal block thing there, even though the NFL will probably get mad at us. Just put up small so they don't see it. Magic Twitter went crazy, and my best were there was a whole bunch of tweets that were some variation on Cassius Marsh with the counter spell.
Yeah, right. Boom.
Boom. Nope. Hashtag nope.
I think a field goal is a 3CMC spell. That would make sense to me, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, that was sick, though. And Bill Belichick even got riled up about
it. Dude, you never see Belichick celebrate, but he was like, yeah, nice, nice.
Good job, Cassius.
So, good to see Cash doing well over
Great
there.
Great to see Cash doing well.
All right, back to our sister podcast, The Masters of Modern. Alex Kessler and Ben Bateman. They talk about surprise, surprise, the modern format, and all things competitive Magic. There's a whole lot of modern events next year, so it's a format that you might want to think about jumping into, and those guys know their stuff, so that's a good place to find out about it. You can find them at collected.company right next to us, or follow them on Twitter at the MMcast.
The editor for this show is Terry Robertson, and he does the video and audio podcast. So if you want to watch the video version, please head on over to youtube.com/thecommandzonepodcast. If you haven't seen it, we have a very cool backdrop where we are currently hanging out on
Azkanta.
We've Azkanta. Searched for it. We found it. And
we came, we saw, we made a podcast.
It's nice. Yeah, it's really nice here. I'm surprised you can't hear the giant waterfall splashing behind us. But yeah, you're going to have to.
Well, there's soundproof windows.
Didn't we have wind at one point?
Scary wind.
Scary wind, yeah.
Just like Sleepy Hollow wind.
And special thanks to Jeffrey Palmer, who does the Living Cards animation, such as this one behind us. We have a couple people helping us. Jeffrey did this one in particular. Awesome guy. Make sure you follow him on Twitter at LivingCardsMTG.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening.
And we will see you next time.
Peace.
Thank you for your attention. For further inquiries, send an email to commandcast@rocketjump.com or ask us on Twitter at JF Wong and at Josh Lee Kwai. See you later, alligator.
Greetings, humans.
Hey, I'm Nolan Sykes, a host of Past Gas, the number one automotive podcast in the world. Every week, my co-hosts, James Pumphrey, Joe Weber, and I bring you some of our favorite stories from the hallowed halls of car history. From the amazing, to the weird, to the utterly unforgettable moments, we cover it all. Join us as we take a look at the wild stories and larger-than-life characters behind legendary cars and car makers. So if you love cars or just like a good story, check out Past Gas by Donut Media, the number one automotive podcast in the world.